This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 216. Today we speak with Owen Strand about the pastor as scholar and the scholar as pastor. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 216. We're happy to be back with another week of theological discussion. We have with us today Nick Batzig. He's church planner in Richmond Hill, Georgia at New Covenant, PCA Church. Welcome back to the program, Nick. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Camden. It's great to be on.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on, especially for today's topic. But first, I want to welcome back to the program Jared Oliphant, who's regional coordinator for Westminster Theological Seminary. He's in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Jared. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be on.
Yeah, and today we're going to be speaking about a fantastic subject about the pastor as scholar, and we are very delighted to welcome to the program Owen Strand, who is assistant professor of Christian theology and church history at Boyce College in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to the program, Owen. It's great to have you.
Thank you very, very much. Glad to be on the program. Appreciate it.
We are delighted to have you on. You've got some excellent experience. We were speaking before the recording started about your dissertation in the evangelical mind, looking at the history of evangelical thought in the 20th century. And today we're going to be unpacking the topic of the pastor as scholar and the scholar as pastor. That is the title of Owen's new book, Reflections on Life and Ministry, the subtitle, and we're delighted to speak about that today. But before we do that, I need to mention a few things. First, that Christ the Center is listener-supported, and if you enjoy what we do and are able to help, please visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. We rely on the generous support of our listeners to help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate and help us to continue Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, Nick, do we have any news? I know that you have something you'd like to mention before we get started.
Sure. I guess a couple days after this will air, on February 19th, I will be the weekend of February 19th, beginning on Friday night, I'll be at Reedy River Presbyterian Church in Greenville, South Carolina, doing a sort of mini conference on church planning. I think there will be a couple other church planners there. So if any of our listeners are in the Greenville area and they can come to that, would love to meet listeners and just be encouraged in fellowship, and wanted to spread the word about that. So thanks for letting me announce that.
Yeah, it's important, and we always want to let people know about events happening in their area. So if you are listening and you have a day or two to get to that and you're in the area, please either contact Nick. How can they get a hold of you or get more information?
They could email us at the church website, newcovpress@gmail.com, they could send me a Twitter message if they decide to follow me. They can direct message me on Twitter. That's a self-aggrandizing plug there. So
that's fine. Twitter's a great place to communicate. So check that out, February 19th, 2012. Well, Owen, we're so delighted to have you on to discuss this book. It's published by Crossway. Crossway keeps doing great resources, constant source of interesting books and edifying books, I should say. And we have before us here The Pastor as Scholar and The Scholar as Pastor, Reflections on Life and Ministry. But as we get started, I'd like to just let the listeners know a little bit about your academic background, where you studied and what you studied, because I think it's going to lay a nice foundation and a context for our discussion this morning.
Sure thing. Again, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on this podcast, great podcast. My educational background, in a nutshell, I grew up in Maine. Went to a public high school on the coast of Maine, about 160 students. Went to a small liberal arts college in southern Maine called Bowdoin College, very secular, named one of the most secular schools in the country by Princeton Review. And it was there that, in God's kindness, he got a hold of my heart and just lit me on fire for Christ. And so did a degree in history there, and then went on to Capitol Hill Baptist Church interned with Mark Dever in 2004, graduated Bowdoin in 2003, I should say. And from there went on to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary from 2004 to 2007. Did an MDiv in Biblical and Theological Studies, and then from there went to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Deerfield, Illinois, to do a PhD in Theological Studies with a concentration in Historical Theology. And I wrote specifically in my thesis, which I just completed last month, so my brain is slowly returning to normal functioning. just wrote a thesis on Billy Graham, Carl Henry, Harold Ockengay, and a host of others, and how they reengaged the evangelical mind, reinvigorated it in the mid-20th century. So as you can tell by the basic title and content of this book that we are discussing, The Pastor, Scholar, The Scholar's Pastor, there was a lot of overlap of interest between my thesis and this particular project.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated to hear about your experience, and I'm thankful you rehearsed that for us so the listener can know, especially about that internship at Capitol Hill Baptist Church, because I think Mark Dever is somebody that we all admire in terms of his ability to deal substantively with issues. A man who takes time to study, but also a man who has a strong ecclesiology and a view of the church and of the pastoral ministry. So I think, do you find that experience in particular helped you or added a useful dimension to your book?
Yeah, I would say it definitely did. I mean, Dever, I consider a pastor theologian. So in other words, a pastor who is equipped and able to do theology, to write theology, to lead the church in theological matters. And so that was formative for me. I didn't have the categories that David Mathis, my co-editor, and I have articulated in this book, Pastor as Scholar. Of course, the authors proper are John Piper and Don Carson, I should mm-hmm. say. You know, this isn't a monograph by me. But Dever, in terms of my influence, yes, definitely showed me the force, the power of a pastor who has gone deep in his studies and is an expert academically, and who can bring the force of his training to bear on his pastoral ministry, and in particular his preaching. His preaching beautifully demonstrated the power of a developed mind. And so, yeah, that was formative for me.
Oh, and this last summer, I got to sit in one of Dever's intern meetings. I had a buddy that was an intern, I guess, after you there, and was just incredibly impressed with how, you know, he has all the interns sit around his desk and they do their papers, and then you have all the pastors in there, and just the way that that he really fosters that deep theological thinking for the church. How, you know, they even talk about what books they're going to have out and sell based on, you know, the theology, and, you know, is this something we think will be good for our people? And I was blown away with how well done it was.
Yes. I mean, he's intentional about everything. The socks he puts on all the way to the books that are chosen for different events. And that's great. And yes, I mean, the funny thing about Dever and Piper and some of these other guys, Phil Ryken, who I've talked about this subject with, is that a lot of them disavow this idea that they are pastor theologians. They back away from it. So I don't know if you guys saw the Piper Carson event that the Henry Center did several years back after the 2009 Gospel Coalition National Conference. But I got to interview Piper and Carson about this very topic, and Piper backed away from this idea that he is a pastor theologian, as does Dever. But going back to Dever, the funny thing is that nobody has more pushed the conversation on the theological identity of the church than Mark Dever. Right. In other words, he's not just writing books about, you know, spiritually savoring the life of the church, which is in itself very valuable. No, he's actually working on, I guess you could say, an academic, but certainly a theological level to develop our understanding of the importance of the local church. So he is acting as a pastor theologian, at least in my view.
Well, here's a question for you. Perhaps the reaction is a different definition of pastor than what we might find in just some random church in the Midwest or in the South, wherever. Do you find that pastor, as office, the office of pastor, has built within it the concept of theologian? Do you think that maybe they're backing off because they see it as a tautology?
Absolutely. I think you're right. I think that pastors have been trained in this last century that they are not theologians. So there is this bifurcation of pastor and scholar, pastor and theologian, that crops up in the 20th century and that I find manifestly unhelpful. I think that in short, that every Christian is a theologian, if you want to back
right.
up from there.
Yeah,
every Christian's a theologian. And in a meaningful sense, we are a kingdom of priests. That's a real calling in a sense. But then also every pastor in a slightly different way is a theologian. Of course, you're interpreting the word of God to people. You are mediating truth to people in a sense. And then beyond that, there is another sense in which there is a kind of office or call specifically of broader theologian.
Yeah.
In which, you know, a person, whether a scholar or a pastor or both, to confuse the categories intentionally, does provide broader theological leadership. But certainly, at the outset, before we dig into any one of those levels, I want to say every Christian's a theologian, every pastor's a theologian, and so to back away from this idea of theologian is problematic. But I know, having said all of these things, what pastors are trying to avoid. Someone
yes.
like John Piper is trying to avoid saying, yes, I am a technical scholar in the sense that you know, my tutors in Germany were technical scholars. He's trying to say he's not that. And in that sense, I of course understand what he's after.
And you know, there's something beautiful about both the way that Carson and Piper, and I would even throw Schreiner in there. I've listened to a good bit of his preaching over the last couple of years. And you know, these are men that have a great breadth of learning. And maybe, you know, Carson's a little more heady in his delivery than Piper and even Schreiner are in their preaching. But all of them kind of break down. They incorporate the breadth of their theology into sermons that I think any Christian seeking to grow spiritually should be able to benefit from. You know, it's not shooting over the head, huge terminology. They know how to break it down, and that's a real gift.
Absolutely. Tom Schreiner is my pastor, and I can say that he does do that. I mean, here's the thing, you know, talking about theology, being a theologian, can be a third rail issue for many Christians in our day. I mean, the American Evangelical Church has a largely negative view of formal theology. And there are lots of reasons for that that you guys could bring to the table and that I could bring to the table. But at base, when you get a taste of meaty preaching, let's throw out the terms, right? When you get a taste for excellent, rich, thick biblical theology, even a little bit of systematic theology, but especially preaching the point of the passage with nuance and clarity. When you get a taste of that kind of meaty, not milky preaching, you love it. You grow by it. And so, yes, if you're bringing certain terms to the table, some people are going to excuse themselves and say, you know, I don't really want this conversation to take place. But so many people in whom the Spirit of God resides are going to have a natural, unslakable thirst and hunger, I think, for theology once it's presented to them in a powerful way.
Yeah. Oh, and just a question. What do you do with, I'm sure you see it either at a college setting or just when you're out there interacting with people, what do we do with those who want to present what I think to be a false dichotomy that if we go too far down this road, we're not going to be concentrating on helping people, the broken people in the church, the real kind of service aspect of the church. And I guess my question would be pointed this way. It's just, how can these deep theological truths and an unrelenting emphasis on them help those types of situations so that we don't make that false dichotomy?
That is a great question. I mean, that's really at the heart of things. When I talk to people about this subject, people who are interested, you know, in this kind of model of the pastorate, but who have not seen it modeled themselves, and so are a little bit skeptical, again, not antagonistic to it, but just haven't seen it in practice, this is where the conversation naturally goes, and this is where it should go. So, for example, you know, people will say, okay, so you want pastors now to write books about theology. What about their counseling ministry? What about discipleship?
Yeah.
What about right. administration of the church? Oh,
right.
I get it. This is just a blank check for you and your pastoral friends to be eggheads in your studies. That's possible that we would all want to do that. I'm guessing you guys all love the study and the solace
sure.
of the study and reading. But that's not at all the point of this. It's the opposite point. We want pastors to go very deep in their theological study, so that to, in other words, to embrace and embody this call to be a theologian through their pastoral ministry, because we want discipleship, counseling, evangelism, and perhaps especially preaching to be all the more robust.
Yeah.
So I don't want pastors to go read Augustine and Edwards and others so that they can just, you know, argue with their friends over coffee about the finer points of theology. I actually want them to do that too. But I want them primarily to get out there and use that theology and put it to work, mm-hmm. so to speak. So hopefully these things are not antagonistic, but the pastor's theologian model enfranchises pastors to be who they are called to be.
Now, this reminds me of John Piper's book or call when he says, "Brothers, we are not professionals." What does he mean by that, and how might that relate to this misconstrual of the pastor as a scholar who just professionally studies and then comes out of his office once a week to deliver a sermon?
Yeah, I think a lot of what Piper was reacting to in that very helpful book was against this kind of CEO model of the pastorate. I'm sure that there are other problems he tackles in the book. I know that there are. But I think that's one of the major things that he's tackling. And he's trying to say, look, so he's not coming exactly from the angle we're discussing here, but it's very
it's related.
Simpatico, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
he's saying we are not first and foremost business leaders. We are spiritual guides. If I can be forgiven for saying this, we are mystics. You know, we're bringing news of another realm to people in a fallen world. And that is essential for those of us who are interested in the pastor as theologian model to understand. We are first and foremost called to understand God's word and to delve into it richly and deeply. So there's a lot of overlap there. We're not to first and foremost think of ourselves as CEOs, as administrators even, as visionary leaders. Those are all things that it'd be great if we were, right? We'd all love to be under excellent and multi-gifted pastors. But first and foremost, we are to do theological and biblical work.
Hey, Owen, I'm wondering if there's not several reasons why we find ourselves in the situation we're in America with the church. I think, and correct me if you think this is off at all, but you know, we all have strengths. Studying theology is a very easy thing for me. I mean, ever since I've been converted, that's all I've wanted to do. And I'm probably more given to reading and I enjoy that. That's a hobby even, you know, not just my lifeline spiritually, but that's what I want to do in my free time is I want to read theology. I want to read biographies. But a lot of men are not given to that, and they have strengths I don't have. And I have to work very hard to compensate in other areas of my life where I know as a pastor I need to grow so that, you know, the theology is working itself out in my life. And I think other men are maybe more pastoral naturally. They're more, you know, they have other strengths and they're not given to study. So it almost becomes an excuse not to do deeper theological study. Do you think that's probable in some cases?
I definitely do. Yes. I mean, there's a lot to say about something like that because, again, this is a kind of crux issue. Fundamentally, again, yeah, we're not calling – I'm not trying to call – David Mathis and I aren't trying to call pastors merely to lock themselves in their study more. And we do realize that there are going to be pastors who naturally are inclined to theology and who might be tempted to neglect different areas of their pastorate. So we don't in any way want to encourage that. What we do want to see happen is a rising tide occur. We want to see pastors across the board look at some of these leading lights from the present and the past and say, okay, I'm not going to be Jonathan Edwards. I am not going to be Charles Spurgeon. I'm just not. And David and I try to be very clear in talking about this. We're not saying you should be, right? But what we are trying to say is realize that the office that you hold, this pastoral office, is an inherently theological one. Okay, so with that groundwork established, enjoy the work that you are doing. If you are a people person, if you are a doer, you know, you're not so inclined to the life of the mind, God bless you. Keep doing your work. But realize again, that you hold this office and that there is an amazing opportunity before you to feed your people. There's nothing more significant you can do than to feed your people rich Bible and theology. So that's where I'm sort of starting from.
Now that's extremely helpful. Let's bring a point or a focus to this. And the two men that are featured, their biographies, you mentioned, of course, John Piper and D.A. Carson. Can you describe the life and ministry briefly of each of these men and why they were selected for this work?
Yes, John Piper, because in our estimation, he is the pastor in our generation who has most embraced a kind of scholarly model of ministry. And again, by scholarly, we just constantly have to be clarifying here. I don't mean writing, 2,000 footnote works of technical theology for obscure German presses. I mean doing high-level theology for the church. So that's how I'm understanding scholarly there. He has, in his ministry at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minnesota, preached soaring sermons for many years. He's written different books that are designed to build the life and the faith of the church. And so that's a major reason why he came to mind. He fits in that kind of historic model that we've talked about, which really is the reformational model of pastoral ministry. I mean, if you're going back in time, you're looking at figures like Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and many others, their descendants, the Puritans, the Neo-Puritans, and you're seeing this model of the pastor scholar, the pastor is theologian. And so we figured that Piper was a good model, one who very much fit that mold. And then with Don Carson, we're getting at the second aim of the book, the scholar as pastor. So in other words, we're not just after pastor theologians and the stimulation of that group in this book. We're after scholars who are admittedly a much smaller subset than the first group, pastors. But we're after scholars turning their attention to the church and not merely trying to talk with one another about arcane theology, again, which in my view has importance, is important. Mm-hmm. There's a major trickle-down effect from those upper echelons of the academy, the theological academy, to the church. But we're trying to say, look at a figure like Don Carson, who has taught for 4 decades at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School and has trained thousands of pastors and has written not every book but many books to strengthen the local church. That's a great model for a scholar. Doesn't mean that you only need to write to one level, one group of people, but as a scholar, an excellent one, you know, trained with an Oxbridge education, that sort of thing, you can invest in people and see them built up in the faith as a scholar.
Yeah, and maybe we can just piggyback off that, and we can go back to the pastor. But I wanted to, what can we learn from the people who do model this correctly within the seminary context? I think we're speaking of when we say scholar. What are some of the examples that you can think of? I mean, from my days in seminary, I think of, you know, I would walk out of a class and hear a bunch of students say that could have been a sermon, you know, and clearly there, you know, there's some differences, but the relationship of the person who is teaching in a seminary and training pastors and their own individual relationship to the local church and their intentionality that they show either in their works or just how they minister in the church. I know there's a lot to be said there, but thoughts on that?
Yeah, there certainly is. And I'm sure you could speak to this very well. In fact, I'll answer, and I'd love to hear thoughts from your background with your father, who's a leader, an eminent scholar. But anyway, I think that a scholar can first and foremost in their ministry exemplify these concerns. So a scholar, again, I think very much should be, we're talking about a seminary scholar, for example, div school scholar in our movement, or Christian college professor, what have you. But a scholar can and should be engaged in the academic discussions that we've already referenced several times. Those are important. Let me say that publicly, right? I mean, I know you guys agree with me, those high-level discussions of the finer points of theology really do matter. So let's just say that. I'm not trying to call scholars in any way away from that sort of ministry. I think they should be engaged in it. But there's a way to be engaged in those things that is merely intramural, and then there is a way that one can be engaged in them that has a focus on the church. So you understand all the theology you're sifting and producing, ultimately, hopefully, to bear on and inform and shape the life of the church. So just if a scholar just has that mentality in place as they're in their study, as they're working, as they're teaching in their classroom, giving their lectures, I think that's going to make a big difference. And then if the scholar, if the theologian has a heart for students, that obviously shows an emphasis as well. And then it's great. It's so good. It's essential, but it's so good when you see a theologian, a professor plugged into the life of the local church, serving it in myriad ways, teaching, preaching, discipling, training, leading evangelistic Bible studies. I know of a professor here at Boyce College, Denny Burke, a very promising young scholar who goes to the Crisis Pregnancy Center once a week, leads people from his church there, and prays for those who are going into abortion clinics and,
wow.
and tries to minister to them, as Carl Henry did. Carl Henry, by the way, the great Baptist theologian of the 20th century, was known among his Fuller Seminary students for showing up to classes looking haggard. Why? Because he didn't take care of himself? No, because he would be on the streets of Pasadena at night evangelizing homeless people. And then he would go to his study, you know, and be reading the works of Bultmann and Barth. And so that is an elegant example for me from the recent historical past of what a scholar can and should be.
You know, Camden, you guys will appreciate this. When I was a boy, my parents were good friends with Dr. Van Til, and this was after his wife had died. And it was said that he would get on a train and take a train from Philly to Trenton. My parents would sometimes have to take him, drop him off, and then he'd say, "Can you pick me up here, you know, at the end of the day?" And he did this for several months. And finally, my parents and some of their other friends said to him, "You know, why are you going to Trenton on a train every day? Why, you know, what are you going to do there?" And he said he had met a man at a coffee shop and he was witnessing to him for like 3 months, and he would take a train from Philly to Trenton. And this is a guy who was very academic, you know, and same kind of thing as what you said, Owen. Like, that's a beautiful story. When I hear that, that invigorates me to say, look, you can be disciplined in your theological study, and you can care deeply about the mission of God in reaching the lost. And that's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. And I just want to say very quickly, you guys are all deeply affiliated with Westminster, obviously, but, you know, J. Gresham Machen, I'm not thinking so particularly right now of leading a small group or something like that, but J. Gresham Machen is nothing less than a hero to myself and many others for the way that he was so deeply concerned about the church and that mission, that ministry. You've talked about Van Til, Nick, and that's a wonderful story. I'm gonna tell that to others, but you know, Machen is an example of a brilliant mind, a top shelf mind, you know, and even someone like H.L. Mencken realized that and respected him. But he's an example of a top shelf mind who gave himself to the church. What an incredible gift one can give.
Machen, actually, when Westminster Theological Seminary was started in Philadelphia, they were renting some apartments from one of the early professors. I forget who it was. I don't know if it was Woolley or somebody.
I think it was Alice.
O.T. Alice, that's right. And they were down on Pine Street in Center City. And Machen's heart was always that the seminary would be in Center City. Hmm. I've spoken to this with John P. Galbraith, who's 98 years old now and was a student of Machen. And he said his heart's desire was that the seminary would always be downtown. In Philly, they don't call it downtown, they call it Center City, because then they would be able to reach men in the homeless shelters and be able to minister, and that students would be there for class, but also be able to preach to men and evangelize to, at the time, what they called the unfortunate men of the streets. and it's a little bit sad, because when Machen passed away, this has been relayed to me from Mr. Galbraith, but when Machen passed away, they used a lot of his bequest. And for various reasons that are understandable, but they eventually moved the seminary, and it's in a suburb now called Glenside. And it's much more difficult to get down into the city, but it just goes to show Machen's ultimate desire was not that they would just produce people who would be interacting with German liberalism or people who would be able to write theological books. or just specialists in their field, but men who would also take that knowledge as a foundation and a motivating factor for doing the very real and important task of preaching the gospel and educating and speaking and helping and counseling even people who are addicted to drugs or alcohol or any number of other things.
Yes, that's really good to hear. I mean, getting to the center city of our great sort of global cities in America is very difficult and only becoming far more difficult.
Yeah.
But man, I don't know if you guys have any billionaires listening to this podcast, but if you do, what a worthy aim to undertake to drive, you know, seminary presence to the heart of the city. My wife went to Moody Bible Institute and got a good education there, and so I was able to see firsthand what it can look like for even a Christian college, obviously a Christian Bible college, to be right in the heart of things. Just an amazing ministry can be had through that. But anyway, we're kind of
Owen, I wanted to ask too your thoughts on just something that hits home to me as a church planter. You know, I came to a South Georgia peninsula. I mean, we're a suburb of Savannah, Georgia, and I remember talking to another pastor when I came here, not in the PCA, and he said, well, if you're going to reach people in Richmond Hill, you better tone down your theology and you better tone down your vocabulary, and basically telling me, you know, be a lot less theological. And
yes,
that whole false dichotomy, I think. And when I came here, you know, the people that we gathered by God's grace, they had not been taught theology very well. And, you know, it was evident that they had been under, some of them had been under ministries for, you know, 20 years, and they didn't know basic theological things. Now, a year later, I see the way they have grown tremendously. Like you said at the beginning of the show, everybody's a theologian. And if you can feed it and break it down to them and break it down, you know, any believer ought to be able to get it. And so my question to you is, how much do you think misperceptions about, you know, certain inner city demographics and country, southern, small town country demographics, that's wrong probably to have that idea that these people can't in some way, you know, become themselves good theologians if they're true believers?
Oh, man. I think that's a lie of Satan, that Christians can't tackle, you know, expanding theological concepts and that sort of thing. That's a really nice scheme on the part of the wicked one to get churches to lower their sights and to not feed their people, to leave their people malnourished. So I've mentioned it earlier, but I think of Hebrews 5 with the author's discussion of milk and meat.
Yeah.
And this author just excoriates various Christian leaders for not giving their people meat. And
that's
I
right.
think,
that's
you
right.
know, you know, this is a little bit portentous, but, you know, if Jesus were to speak to churches today, I just could imagine him having that kind of rebuke for us, that we are not feeding our people meat. So are you going to have to be careful depending on where you go? Are you going to have to be a translator of, you know, biblical theology and systematic theology to your people? Are you going to have to train them to have a hunger for the deep stuff, the good stuff of Scripture? Yes, you are. You're going to have to be patient. You're going to have to be wise. You're going to have to make hard decisions about whether you use the 50-cent words that we all on this call appreciate and love. Are you, you know, how are you going to do that in your own individual context? I'm from small town Maine, you know. So I'm going to have to, if I go back there, I'm going to have to make some very hard decisions about how I start my ministry and what sort of cast it has.
Sure.
But yes, absolutely. I think that every Christian can grow by leaps and bounds once the Word of God is opened to them and is not explained in some sort of kind of lecture way, but in a rich, grand, dramatic kind of sermon. That captures a little bit of what Kevin Van Hooser has talked about in the drama of doctrine. If you're exhibiting that kind of ministry, I think the general rule is going to be that people can't help but grow and can't help but love
right.
your ministry. You're going to encounter opposition. I don't mean that. You know, there's no way to silence darkness. That's a mixed metaphor. There's no way to silence the enemy or something like that.
Mm.
But you can certainly light a fire writ large in your people, I think if you delve deep and produce fantastic sermons for the glory of God.
And I guess also getting them excited about reading books. That's when I think about the guys in the book that you guys have edited, you know, Carson and Piper and Dever, and all these men are always promoting good books, historically reformed books, you know, early church books, telling people to read good books. I think about one story about Samuel Davies, the president of the College of New Jersey after Edwards. And Davies would often go over to England to raise money for Princeton, what is now Princeton Seminary. And he would go over there and he would raise money to support the College of New Jersey. And he would bring back books. He would buy the books on his own and he would bring them back. And he was from Virginia, and he would travel through the Shenandoah Valley, and he would give the books to actually the slaves who he would meet along the way. Well, Archibald Alexander, who ends up being, you know, a revival preacher and a sort of a church planter through the Shenandoah Valley before he's president of Princeton Seminary, he writes about how he came across all these black theologians, you know, this long time after Samuel Davies, and he asked them, how did they become so theologically educated? And they were the descendants of the people that Davies had given those books to. And so we often, you know, Davies didn't see the fruit of that, but, you know, Archibald Alexander did. So emphasizing a book ministry seems like a pretty significant thing, too, for pastors to do for their people.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I mean, look, we're up against many different obstacles in terms of feeding the sheep, feeding evangelicals. And evangelicals have been raised on milk. They have been raised on self-help therapy. They've been raised on, you know, five steps to improve your life. That's what people are getting writ large. They're getting sort of, in many instances, you know, a kind of prosperity gospel light, not a hard prosperity gospel, but a kind of a light one in many pulpits. But look, when you give them this kind of rich theology that we are talking about as practiced by the great leaders of the Christian past, you know, Luther, Calvin, Edwards, Spurgeon, et cetera, Machen, you know, these kind of guys, ESPN or therapy or soap operas cannot compete. So, you know, if the battle is very superficial, in the short term, you're going to lose some of these fights because people are not trained to think deeply, just broadly in American culture. But if you persevere, and most importantly, I think if as a pastor you embody a theological ministry and you're bringing the delights, the discoveries of a theological biblical life to your ministry, and that's pouring out of your pulpit and out of your counseling, like we talked about earlier, out of your evangelism, out of your discipleship, then that is going to be irresistible, I think. The Spirit of God is behind all of this. The Spirit
that's
of
right.
God does not malnourish and weaken Christians. The Spirit of God desires, above all else, to strengthen believers. So where we invest as pastors, in whatever place, whether you have 2,000 people, 5,000 people, 50 people, 200 people, where you invest and pray and ask God to work in these kind of ways, I believe in some form, you know, without sort of numerical guarantees, that God is going to bless your efforts.
That's right.
Yeah, and isn't this topic just completely fused to, you know, the dialogues going on right now with the mission of the church and how the proclamation of the word, and if you're going to be proclaiming the word, you know, how you need to be studying the word, in the word, reading other people in the word, and also dialoguing with people. And, you know, that starts with training when either you're in seminary or you're under a pastor or whatever. But I see those two things as so linked today that, you know, if you're emphasizing the proper mission of the church, these kinds of things will get out in proper priority.
Yes, that is a great connection, Jared, because if you are believing that the mission of the church is primarily, you know, the church gathered in its weekly worship is to proclaim the gospel, and so you are a pastor who are leading that charge, what are you going to do but take your office, your work, with deadly seriousness? You're going to do that, right? Whereas if you think that you're supposed to do 10 different things and you're supposed to be a community organizer and a sort of visionary leader and all the sorts of things, you know, that are out there in the evangelical sphere today, and many of them, by the way, are good, but if you're thinking that you're supposed to be 10 different things within a given week, you're not going to feed your people richly, I don't think.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a necessary connection. If you believe that proclamation is of the utmost importance, you are going to work extremely hard to feed your people. And God will work. He will work.
Owen, you had a pretty good post, I thought, that a friend of yours had written that you had posted on your blog the other day about pastor planners drinking from the well of theology. And the point your friend makes at the end of that about reading more than just for sermon prep. Could you elaborate some of your thoughts about that for our listeners about diversifying, as it were, your reading, not just, you know, limiting it?
Right. The post was by a guy named Gerald Heastend, who is executive director of the Society for the Advancement of Ecclesial Theology, basically a society to stimulate the pastor theologian model. There's a yearly gathering of this society, and it's been a really powerful stimulant in my life in thinking and processing these things. And Gerald, in a post on the SAT blog, said exactly as you have just said, that pastors should be constantly reading. Not just to get a pithy quote for the Sunday intro, but to actually be formed and shaped by theology. So if you are reading Chrysostom, Augustine, Anselm, Luther, Calvin on a regular basis, and what Gerald recommended was for just a couple hours, 2-3 hours a day, in the morning, he said. Now, every pastor can do this differently. You know, there's definitely room for that. But Gerald said, as a pastor, he's a pastor in Illinois, he tries to do that on a daily basis. And he said that he believes he should do that because he wants all of his ministry to be richer. And I think that is exactly right. By the way, you don't even need to be a pastor to engage in this kind of life. Just being a Christian who is constantly reading and engaging the top shelf stuff is going to transform you. So if you are constantly bringing yourself into contact with great preaching and great theologizing from the Christian past, that is going to shape who you are as a father, who you are as a husband, who you are as a counselor, who you are as an evangelist. And you will have, instead of having, you know, 120 horsepower engine that can barely get up over a little hill of trial, you're going to have a 400 horsepower, you know, Shelby Cobra Mustang by which you can navigate the twists and turns of the Christian life. And you're just going to roar. And that's a beautiful thing.
Owen, I wanted to ask you about the pastor-scholar model, all the themes of this book. Now, in relation to a new world, we've got a connected world with a lot of social media, blogs, etc. What are some lessons we can learn and things we can put into practice as people geared towards pastoral ministry, but also intense scholarship? How ought we to interact in this new connected environment?
Well, I think that, you know, Twitter and Facebook and blogs and all that sort of thing can be distractions, right? So we all know very well what it can be to, you know, boot up your computer in the morning and just sort of get carried on the...
Next thing you know, it's lunch and you're
that's
like,
right.
What?
That's right. And all you've done is, you know, basically read some sports articles and some funny tweets from your friends and, you know, I don't know, checked out some profile pages. Okay, that's not a great use of your time, I don't think. But I do think that that all of this kind of new media can facilitate the kind of life that we're talking about. Because if you are engaging in the kind of pastor theologian model, you're going to have all kinds of resources at your fingertips that you can point people to. So, you know, for let's just say Twitter. You can use Twitter really badly. You can make yourself a kind of self-appointed celebrity and be talking about all the cool things that you're doing and, I don't know, complain about all the little things that go wrong in your day, and that's just a foolish use of your time. Or you could use Twitter in a more edifying way, and you could try to point people, you know, to the resources we've been talking about. That's one thing that I would say. You can also, you know, in a blog or something like that or a podcast, you know, you can be presenting the fruits of your labors. You can be working out theology. That can be a stimulant, you know, to you to engage the life of the mind. So, you know, if you're a pastor and you realize you want to read more and write more, you know, a blog, which didn't exist really 10 years ago, can be a great way for you to sort of test drive the life of the mind. I don't know if you had another angle you wanted to go
No, that's there. Excellent. I was just opening it up, and it's another dimension on this conversation that just didn't exist several years ago. Technology's always been there. I mean, technology's been, you know, Adam could farm. He had technology. But it, I mean, it is advanced to the point now where things are so different just in human interaction.
Yeah.
And there are strains on our time, but also there are new tools for promoting this type of model. I mean, I can read somebody's blog. If it's an insightful blog, I'll spend time reading somebody's post. I can look up journal articles on databases. I can bounce ideas off people in Australia. There's awesome, amazing new opportunities now for the pastor to sharpen himself in new ways. But yet, yes. Of course, with that, there are also many dangers. And I think your comments are very insightful.
I mean, you think about something like Justin Taylor's blog, which all of us read, right? I mean, it's kind of people have said it's the bulletin board for conservative or reformed evangelicalism, and it really is. I mean, you look at the Gospel Coalition, for example, now, and it's kind of making a run to be the clearinghouse for evangelical news and commentary, you know, giving past leaders a run for their money. I mean, so you look at these things, and these are tremendous developments. I would say, though, if you are going to develop this kind of pastorate, you know, this kind of pastor as scholar model, you're going to have to steward the new media, right? I mean, like we just mentioned, but you're going to have to do that. You need accountability. Mm. You need to talk to your elders. You need to talk to people in your local church, that sort of thing. You need to talk to your wife, and you need accountability, because if you're going to read, if you're going to especially make a commitment to reading and reading deep and textured works from the past that really require you to plug in and engage, and you know, you don't read 50 pages an hour. You might read 15 if you're working through Edwards' philosophy or mm-hmm. You know, Aquinas or something like that.
Owen.
Yeah, you're gonna have to turn off some of this stuff. And I do think that is sometimes an overlooked feature of personally growing yourself.
Yeah. That brings us back to that thought about discipline and how important it is, not just in time, but also in sharpening our minds for service of the church, but also sharpening our minds so that we can conduct our scholarship properly.
Yeah. Yes.
So one of the concerns that I know we've had on the forum is that because there's so much out there on blogs and everybody voices their opinions, that a lot of young guys, well, men and women, who are not as grounded in historical theology, tend to say, well, I believe this, so-and-so said this, and, you know, so-and-so said this, and did you read this post over here? I thought this was right. And they're not taught to think critically. And I wonder how we can encourage everything you're saying to a younger generation to say, listen, don't believe every word. Don't, just because this sounds good on a prima facie reading, think this is right. Because that seems like a real danger. You know, I actually think, and disagree with me, please, if you do, but that not everyone should be writing. That it's not that maybe the Lord doesn't call every pastor and young seminarian to write and to blog.
Yeah, I certainly think that's true. I mean, part of the pull of the new media and the charm of it is that it rewards persuasive writing. You know, and especially in our ironic age, you know, if you can write ironically, if you can mix in humor and social commentary and that sort of thing, you can really win a hearing for yourself when you may not really have any theological bona fides, right?
Right.
So that's a that's a problem, I think, of the age. That's something we have to be aware of. And I don't think young seminarians and pastors and that sort of thing, planters, should feel pressure to be a blogger. You know, should feel pressure to write a book just because all their peers are. If you truly have something bubbling up inside of you that the Lord is giving you through your study, then that's one thing. But there shouldn't be a kind of pressure to get out there. And I think a lot of us have to steward that carefully and examine ourselves in an Edwardsian fashion, kind of a Puritan. We could use a little more Puritan introspection on some of these points, I think. One other thing I would say in terms of combating this problem, Nick, I think would be to be in conversation with extremely wise voices. And that's kind of behind everything that we're saying, right? But that's part of what seminary does for you. That's part of why I think seminary is so good. I don't think seminary is essential. I don't think that you need an MDiv or another degree to go pastor a church. Not at all. I don't think that's the case. I do think, however, that seminary will be of great benefit to just about every one of us, in part because it exposes us to a number of different powerful voices, and it trains us not to give too much weight to any one voice. Now, I don't mean to sound like a postmodern perspectivalist. I don't mean that. But, you know, you come into contact with so many different scholars, and the top professors are going to at least be giving a voice to those they disagree with. And so you're learning intellectual habits through seminary. You're not just apt to hearken to one voice and say, this represents who I think, you know, and therefore you kind of parrot a theologian or a pastor's thought. No, right. You're trained to sift and to think and to evaluate and critically analyze. And those are tools, I think, that are kind of out of vogue in American life today. You know, the life of the mind is waning, I think, in my view at least, writ large. But I think that ideally seminaries and Christian institutions can cultivate those habits.
Yeah, right. I echo that too. We've talked about that a lot on here, and just that, you know, it's often unstated, and you don't find this unless you talk to seminarians who have been through this, but there is a whole other stratum of education that goes outside the classroom when you are with the fellowship of other believers and other, you know, future ministers in just discussing what they're learning in the classroom. And to be able to articulate that to someone who is also studying the same things, to articulate to your professor, you know, back to him to see if you really properly understood that, all that kind of interaction is, you know, it's not a class that you can take, but it's crucial to future ministry, to really understanding those kind of weighty, heavy things that you're getting in the classroom and need to apply outside the classroom, I think.
Oh, that is so true. That is so true. I mean, that is such a richer experience than logging online, you know, watching a video and posting a comment in a discussion forum. And look, I mean, not to turn this into a apologetic for seminary, but I mean, residential seminary, but I mean, we are so grateful, I'm sure, you guys and me, that, you know, distance education makes it possible for people all over the world to get elite training from great theologians, right? I mean, that's a fantastic thing. So let's not try to, you know, we don't want to be misheard here. And Jared, you didn't say anything like that. I sometimes have to make this qualification because I can get heated about this sort of thing. But with that said, I mean, if you're listening to this podcast and you have the opportunity, you know, depending on your convictions to move to the Philadelphia area, or the Louisville area, or other areas, you know, and to plug in a residential community, you are going to reap untold benefits. You really are. It's such a richer experience. It's just like, you know, a medical degree or training for the Navy SEALs. You know, you don't train for SEAL Team 6 online, and you shouldn't train for ministry in the kingdom of God online either if you can help it.
You know, Owen, one of my professors before I went to seminary was encouraging me to come. I went to Greenville Presbyterian, and he was encouraging me to come there, and he said, you know, the school that you go to and why being at a seminary is more valuable than doing distance study, if possible, is because you will form lifelong friendships with brothers who you'll be in ministry with, who will be a support to you. And to this day, I talk to a couple guys that I went to school with almost on a weekly basis and sometimes do sermon prep with them over the phone, talking about theological issues, just like I do on the Reform Forum with these guys. So the benefit is enormous. The friendships, you know, the iron sharpening iron. So
yeah, it's seminary, residential seminary for many people, especially today, is tough. You know, it's tough to move from Maine, for example, to Louisville, Kentucky. You know, you're essentially uprooting your life. You know, it's hard. Guys have young kids. You got to get a job at UPS or something like that because it's hard to find work. And so you're working late hours, and you can just easily get into a situation where you're saying, this is not worth it. But there are at least some of us, I think several of you guys and myself definitely, who have come out on the other side by God's grace and who can say, you know what? It is really hard. So be honest about that. But it's worth it. It's worth it. Friends are a huge part of that, Nick. I think you're right.
Yeah, absolutely. The seminary provides the tools, and our meaningful interactions with one another help us to learn how to use them, and also sharpen the knowledge that we learn, so that we can in turn serve the church in ministry, in whatever form that ministry takes, either pastoral ministry, academic type ministry, whatever. And a seminary is an important part of that. But the enrichment, the fellowship, the sharpening is something that's just part of natural Christian life, is being a member of Christ's body. And this is something that we ought to be doing at some level among all the people. Maybe as we start to wind down, Owen, I'm wondering what this might look like analogously for lay people. How do we promote and encourage lay people to interact with one another substantively in Bible studies or, you know, at the coffee hour, however that may look? How do we promote healthy scholarship in a lay environment type? You know, I'm kind of stretching the use of that word, but scholarship. And also more of what we consider under the heading of pastoral ministry.
Yes. So part of what we're talking about here, I think, is that in too many pulpits, pastors are interpreting expository preaching as restating the text.
Oh, yeah.
They don't have much godly ambition to dig deeply into a passage. They're afraid of going outside of the bounds, and so they stick to merely restating. And I very much want pastors to try to be faithful to God's word and preach the point of the passage, right? But I think that what this model, this pastor theologian model, equips pastors to do is to bring all the fruit of their training to bear on their ministries.
Yeah.
So we want pastors to be helpfully pointing out what Greek and Hebrew words mean, I think. Not to show off, but to help people grasp things that they can't otherwise get. That's what the pastor's being trained to do, right? To advance in knowledge and be able to feed the people in a level they can't feed themselves. We want pastors, furthermore, to be doing biblical theology and even some systematic theology in their preaching. We want them to be pointing out nuances of the passage. We want them to be pointing out literary depth and these sorts of things. So I want pastors to shoot for the fences, so to speak. I want pastors to try, and maybe it takes time, and maybe there's some missteps and that sort of thing. But if a pastor is working with his elders, I think that he can find a good balance of faithfulness, but also what we could call gospel ambition.
Oh, I agree. I think that's excellent. Those are just wonderful statements and encouragement to what a really healthy ministry ought to look like. Owen, I want to thank you personally for joining us. This has really been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on today.
Guys, it's been fantastic. I really appreciate you having me on.
Oh, absolutely, and hopefully we can continue the discussion. Maybe we can get into some of the topic of your dissertation and get more into the background of this issue of the evangelical mind and start to unpack historically. Where some of these thoughts came from.
Well, there's a lot there. You know, the focus of the dissertation was Auchengay.
Yeah.
It's kind of, there are several figures in view, but Auchengay, of course, Westminster trained. I have some letters that haven't really been seen between Auchengay and Machen, and yeah, there'd be overlap, I think, if you ever
and we have some in our archives on from Auchengay and Van Til that I've been reading in the Van Til archives. We'll have to send you some photos of them. We could talk offline.
Yeah.
Well, of course, everybody can visit Owen Strand online at owenstrand.com. owenstrachan. The Gaelic CH, is Nick called it what? The movable CH, Nick?
Yes. There we go. Hebrew guys will like that.
And of course, from Crossway, the new book, The Pastor as Scholar and the Scholar as Pastor, Reflections on Life and Ministry. This is just a great book that we need to read and think about the implications of it more and more as we come to care for God's flock. Of course, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org, and there you'll find information about all of our programs, and you can subscribe to our podcasts, you can read our blogs, etc. We've revamped the website over the last several months and tried to provide a more integrated experience for all of our locations. And, of course, you can visit us on our donate page, reformforum.org/donate, to help us to continue to produce and distribute all of these programs free of charge. If you'd like to get a hold of us, email us at mail@reformedforum.org, or you can tweet us at Reformed Forum. I want to thank everybody for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.